You are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast this week is Dr. Mukund Rajan, Chairman of EQ Investment Advisors. In his previous avatar, Dr. Rajan was the first brand custodian at the Tata Group, the Chief Ethics Officer and Chair of the Tata Global Sustainability Council. Dr. Rajan has also co-authored his latest book, Outlast, How ESG Can Benefit Your Business, with Colonel Rajiv Kumar. He is also the author of The Brand Custodian and a former Rhodes Scholar. Good afternoon, Mukund. Welcome to the Elephant in the Room podcast. Thank you for being a guest.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So congratulations on your new book, Mukund. How did the idea of the book come about, and also the collaboration with Colonel Rajiv Kumar and HarperCollins? And incidentally, Outlast is also a survival game.
Well, the book itself is, I think, quite straightforward in terms of the partnerships. So HarperCollins published my previous book, The Brand Custodian, and they proposed the idea of a book on ESG, which was beginning to gain a lot of currency in India. They jumped on it and said they'd be happy to publish. In fact, I understand this is the first book on ESG in India that's come out. Colonel Rajiv Kumar was my colleague in the Tatas. And when I was the brand custodian at Tatas, we both worked on a whole bunch of issues and also saw a number of ESG crises up close and personal. So when he retired from the group, we'd sort of made a mutual commitment that we'd write something together. And here we are, I think almost 2 years after we made that pact, and we've got a book out.
That's
the subject itself is one that, as I said, is gaining a lot of currency. But in 2018, you know, I left the Tatas and I started my own firm called E-Cube. And E-Cube, as the name suggests, is drawn from three E's: engage and empower for ESG. The whole idea of the firm was to really support the transition of corporate India towards better ESG performance. And critical drivers at the time that my co-founders and I saw were obviously a lot of the focus on corporate governance that was happening in India, but equally growing concerns about climate change as a major issue within the E of ESG. So we really thought the Indian market would be getting ready for much greater focus on ESG issues. And thanks to a lot of the research and the reading one was doing, it made sense to put all this in a book form and make it available to a wider audience. So
that sounds like a wonderful story, actually. So the introductory chapter is titled The Age of Responsibility. What is this age of responsibility? The last 2 years, we've seen purpose become a buzzword for individuals, corporates, and governments. How important is purpose in this age of responsibility?
So the two go hand in hand, Sudha. And, you know, as I mentioned in the book, I sort of outlined the way in which this whole focus on corporate responsibility and concerns around sustainable development has really been evolving over the last few decades. But certainly humankind's ability to go into outer space and looking at the Earth as a tiny blue marble from outer space reminded everyone that there is only this one Earth that we all share. And then going forward into the 1980s, you had the Brundtland Report, which, you know, made the concept of sustainable development famous. Then in the 1990s, you had the Rio Earth Summit, the increasing focus on global environmental issues. Big developments, I think, towards the late 80s and early 90s, obviously the collapse of the Soviet Union. And from a world which is sort of fragmented and polarized between, you know, the non-aligned nations, the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc, you had this gradual tendency moving towards one interdependent global market. So I think in the context of all of these developments, there's been much greater light that has been shined on what is the role of the private sector, businesses and corporates in the context of the kind of new society that's emerging. And obviously greater integration, interdependency, and also the fact that technology is coming to your help now on a variety of issues means there are more choices that could be made in terms of the way in which you want to take development forward. In all of that context, I feel that really we are now poised at a new sort of juncture in human history where there's much more information available with all kinds of stakeholders. The public, thanks to the ubiquity of the World Wide Web, has much greater access to information. And therefore, the demands for accountability from corporates are much greater now. And therefore, this is a new age of responsibility where if you're not careful, you can upset stakeholders in some part of the world and pretty soon see your business, your market share collapse. And that's one of the points we make in the book, that Indian corporates, I don't think, have yet sort of woken up in large numbers to how swiftly the terrain is changing. It's a bit akin to what we saw 30 years back in India in 1991, when you had the economic reforms and India evolved from really a socialist economy, scarcity economy, into one which is much more akin to a free market economy. And at that juncture, many corporates that weren't prepared for change really bit the dust. And this time around as well, if companies don't understand the expectation that stakeholders, not just in India, but overseas, including deep-pocketed investors, have from them, they could stand to lose out big time. So it is a new age of responsibility. On the question of purpose, you know, I have a quote in my book, which interestingly enough is actually Larry Fink's quote at BlackRock. And I think probably it's the best sort of definition I've seen of what purpose can do for businesses. So it's something that really is quite profound. So he says, profits are essential if a company is to effectively serve all of its stakeholders over time, not only shareholders, but also employees, customers, and communities. Similarly, when a company truly understands and expresses its purpose, it functions with the focus and strategic discipline that drive long-term profitability. Purpose unifies management, employees, and communities. It drives ethical behavior and creates an essential check on actions that go against the best interests of stakeholders. Purpose guides culture, provides a framework for consistent decision-making, and ultimately helps sustain long-term financial returns for the shareholders of your company. I think that's the best example I've seen of what purpose can do for businesses. So you're quite right that it's integral to this whole idea of us moving into this age of responsibility. And companies that are not purpose-driven, that don't have a clue about why they're here and which stakeholders they're really intending to serve to the best of their ability through their products and services, I think we'll very quickly sort of get found out. So I think it's critical to explaining to your audience, you know, what you really stand for.
So also given our obsession with fads and trends, is ESG the new fad, you know, old wine, new bottle, or does it really serve a purpose? Is this a new transformation trend that will enable a country like India or other countries actually to meet their SDG commitments?
So SDG is another acronym. So there is this whole mess of acronyms out there that have a lot of people scratching their head, wondering what these all really mean. But no, I think it's all part and parcel of this evolution that we are seeing. So call it by whatever name you want. The fundamental point is that there is an expectation of corporate responsibility, whether it's expressed through your commitment to different sustainable development goals, whether it's expressed through your demonstration of performance on what are called material ESG issues. Nobody's expecting every company to be equally good across the spectrum of ESG issues, but those that are material to your industry, you should be good on those. I think that expectation is now qualitatively different and more measurable than perhaps at any previous point in human history. Like I mentioned, the availability of information is so widespread now that if you have a plant in a Mofussil area in India, for instance, that suddenly starts leaking emissions on big scale, this is something that can get noticed as far away as the United States, and stakeholders will take action. That is qualitatively different from the kind of impacts that you would have seen, say, 30, 40 years back. And because of technology also, people have the tools now to do something about these issues. So I think the visibility, the scrutiny, all of them are qualitatively different of a much higher order. And the expectation of accountability, therefore, is also of a much higher order. And ultimately, it's back to basics. Right? Yeah. You're expected to live the right values. You're expected to comply with the law. You're expected to do your part in really contributing to society and to the development of the community. That's what sustainable development is all about. You want to leave the world a better place than what you inherited. Otherwise, future generations are going to be extremely critical and upset. And you're already seeing that in the behavior of millennials these days, much more environmentally sensitive and conscious. The good news is I think governments are now beginning to be responsive. They're understanding that civil society has these concerns. If anything, the last couple of years, thanks to COVID, I think a lot more people are now much more in tune with nature and understand, you know, the context in which we've been allowed really to impose the natural environment. So I think governments are also now beginning to play their role with regulation, with policies that are, on the whole, I think, proving to be more beneficial. We saw at Glasgow a whole bunch of governments coming together and Absolutely. At least talking the right talk about what they want to do to avert climate change. And we're all in this together. I think that's the one big thing that global environmental issues have really done for us. The fact that, very similar to the same stance we take on COVID, nobody is safe until everybody is safe. You can't deal with the global environmental issue unless everybody collaborates. So I think that need for collaboration means that there are many more agents of change who are keeping an eye on what's going on and trying to collaboratively engineer the changes that are going to be important if humankind is to survive in the long term.
Absolutely. And on this globalization bit, I think in the past couple of years, we've moved towards more local, be local, focus on local. The fact remains that we are hugely interconnected and interdependent. So we can never forget that whenever we're trying to, for example, during times of COVID, address the issue. Unless everyone is safe, no one is safe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's been easier to articulate the E and G in ESG. What does S actually stand for? I mean, people use all sorts of, you know, social, societal, stakeholder. It's fairly ambiguous. So when you're not sure about, you know, what that stands for, how are you going to measure that? Because this is about measurement, right?
So I go back to the point about materiality. I think every business, when it thinks about its ESG impact and where it wants to or needs to improve, we look at what is relevant to its business. And on the S, I mean, the S is a combination, it's essentially social. So it's a combination of elements that may be relevant to the people within your business, your employees, for instance. In India, contract labor is a big issue, for instance. And it applies to the communities around you and outside, the stakeholders that you impact, the human beings who live in those communities. So you really have to decide, you know, what kind of organization you are, where you have the greatest impact, what kinds of communities you need to engage with, and what kind of performance you want to demonstrate going forward. Pick out the most material issues and then focus on those. So in India, for manufacturing, for instance, I think contract labor is a major issue. The terms and conditions under which many, many people labor and work are quite unfair a lot of the time. They work under contractors who don't necessarily provide them the benefits they're meant to under the law. That could be a big issue. The complexion of the workforce, which is part of your organization, is another big issue. In India, as I pointed out in the book, two major challenges that you see across the board. One is gender diversity, and the other is recruitment of members of the scheduled caste, scheduled tribe communities. Again, you see that in the power structure, whether it's corporate India, whether it's a judiciary, whether it's a representation in parliament, these communities, women, the SCST communities, the fiscally challenged, are all very, very poorly represented. So if you want a more equitable society, if you want a more equitable framework in which stakeholders are willing to support what you stand for, you need to do something about where you see gross sort of inequality. And I think many companies can do a lot of things to address these issues, starting with the recruitment policies, the kind of support they provide people within the workforce, the kind of encouragement they give, and to some extent, affirmative action. So I think there's a range of things that you can do. Once you've identified really where you as a company are operating and where you can have the greatest impact and influence. And not enough companies actually apply their minds to that. They sort of take the situation as something that exists and do very little to change it. And my proposition is, if you don't start interesting yourself in the kind of society you're already living within, pretty soon you could see social strife. In a country like India, with the levels of inequality and poverty, it's not surprising that you've had many sort of situations where local communities have erupted in defiance of the operations of a particular corporation. And that doesn't bode well for the future. So before it's too late, I think all businesses need to really understand the context in which they're operating and do more to show that they really are caring and concerned about the future.
Yeah, what you've said is very, very interesting, you know, and it sort of answers the next question that I was going to ask you. Globally, we've seen that the momentum around racism or Black Lives Matter, that has picked up, and that momentum organizations have embraced the reality that there are inequalities and there are issues that they need to align with and work with the communities. So when we talk about ESG, do you also have to be at a certain stage of growth to embark on this journey? Because at this point in time, we don't see that similar momentum or similar push or similar drive in corporate India.
No, absolutely not. I don't think it has anything to do with your stage of development as a market or an economy. I think these principles, I mean, take human rights, for instance. I don't think it matters whether you're a rich country or a poor country. Yeah. Human rights and should be respected regardless. And India, I think, has so much work to do. I mean, take the issue of affirmative action, in particular in favor of scheduled castes, scheduled tribes. You know, you go back around almost 14 years to the 2006-2007 period, when you had the UPA government at the center. And there was a lot of talk at that time about potentially instituting reservation in the private sector. You already have reservation in the public sector for scheduled castes, scheduled tribe communities, but there was talk about introducing it for the private sector. And then you saw a flurry of activity for a few years when Indian corporates tried to put their best foot forward in order to avoid government action legislating this kind of reservation. But somehow the tempo has been lost after that. So some of these issues are not new. They are well understood. They're well known. Take the issue of gender diversity again. There are World Bank studies that actually demonstrate that female participation in the labor force has actually shrunk by 5% in the last 20 years. So this is not something that we were unaware of 20 years back. It has not gotten better. It's gotten worse over time.
Absolutely.
So I don't think your stage of development has anything to do with this. I think it's just a function of one, legislative pressure. Unfortunately, as I point out in my book, too often corporate India responds when the heavy hand of government suddenly looms large. And until then, they sort of coast along doing very little. There are obviously honorable exceptions to this, including some of India's largest firms. I was privileged to be part of the Tata Group for 23 years. And I know that in Tata's, a lot of these issues are taken very seriously and the group tries to do its best. But there is enough scope for Indian businesses to change. And as I keep repeating in the book, if they don't realize that these concerns are becoming quite strong and change fast, I think they will have a very heavy price to pay.
So you've touched on the big issues that corporate India can champion to build a fairer society and workplace. You've mentioned the Tatas as, you know, someone who is doing some work on it. Are there any others who you could sort of spotlight and say, okay, these are the people you should be following and these are the examples that one could be following? Because, you know, if you look at the data and the statistics, it is quite sad. You know, even if you look at CEOs, the female CEOs in India, I think the numbers are just reducing.
Absolutely. And that's a big worry. But, you know, I mean, each corporate house in India, the largest companies are controlled mostly by some of these corporate houses. I think they're beginning to get it. And most of them are trying to do something about it. If I take an issue like climate change now as a major ESG issue, I can see that a lot of at least the larger companies, which also have significant exposure overseas, they have footprints in other markets, they're aware of trends around the globe. I think many of those businesses are really putting their best foot forward, being quite smart about the way they're thinking about business in the future, trying to put in place strategies to address the climate change issue. I mean, one of the best examples is India's largest private sector company, Reliance Industries, despite being in the oil and gas space, has announced a 2035 target to get to net zero, talking about deploying huge amount of investment in new spaces like green hydrogen. So I think the larger companies probably already get it and are beginning to do the right thing. As you go into the small and medium enterprise space, I think you have many more challenges. Many of these businesses don't have the surplus capital to be able to make the right investments. They don't have the kind of exposure which the large corporates do to international trends. They often don't know what the best new technologies are emerging, where they can be procured, which ones they should take a bet on, what kind of risks they are embracing. And that's the space where I really worry about the future, that many of the smaller businesses, you know, how quickly can they adapt to these new changes? And if they're also at risk of getting excluded from the entire commercial process going forward, there are already suggestions that you're seeing increasing concentration take place in the Indian economy. with the big getting bigger, particularly after COVID and the introduction of the GST regulations, the formalization of the economy. And this is a trend you're seeing in other markets also. A lot of the tech firms now are so big, the giants with $1 trillion plus market capitalization. So there is a worry that globally this is a phenomenon. And in India, the worry is that this can exacerbate inequalities that you already see. So I think a lot of work to be done. And I think the political system also has to be responsive to ensure that a lot of this gets controlled in time. So they're not firefighting when a crisis has actually emerged, but you're actually shaping the course of development.
Whose responsibility is it within an organization to lead on this? The CEO, the chief sustainability officer, I don't think there are too many of those, or the CFO, since this
actually,
is about investment.
Actually, there are many more now being appointed, so that's the good news. You know, I would start with the board, because really the board of directors is where a strategy for the company gets set and the kind of guidance they give to the leadership, including the CEO. So I'd start with the board. And I think the good news is increasing numbers of, again, the larger companies in India, you're beginning to see this trend of creating an ESG committee of the board. I think the most recent company to announce that was Airtel. Before that, you had companies like Ashok Leyland and Infosys that created dedicated ESG committees of the board. In some companies, including companies from the Tata Group, like Tata Steel, what they are doing is not creating a new ESG committee, but adding this responsibility to the existing CSR committee of the board and adding on sustainability as one more mandate for that committee. So I think it starts with guidance, the budgets, the support, the focus on strategy and execution at the level of the board and the kind of dedicated focus you give to this issue. And then it cascades to, obviously, the points you made about, is there an empowered set of individuals within the organization whose full-time job is really to worry about the material ESG issues in the company and performance. So it could be the CEO, it could be a chief sustainability officer, but you want somebody who's at the leadership table and ensuring the strategy gets, you know, cascaded across the entire organization. What you don't want is a situation where there's somebody on the fringes. In the old days with CSR and many companies, that used to be the case. It was an inconsequential kind of function which operated on the margins, and nobody took them seriously and nobody had a clue what they were really doing most of the year. You don't want that. So you want alignment. You want this really mainstreamed into the sustainability strategy of the company. You want budgets allocated for it. You want a sense of how the future is going to pan out, what bets you need to take on technology, what kind of investments in R&D and innovation you're going to make, your focus on the circular economy. So all of this requires, I think, a large number of people to be involved and aligned and reporting into the CEO and through the CEO to the board. And to ensure that people take this seriously, I think the simplest device is to link their compensation to ESG-related outcomes. So what gets measured gets improved the moment it becomes part of people's bonuses and calculations on the compensation going forward, they take it much more seriously. So absolutely. I think those are some of the places to start. So it starts really at the top. I think the tone at the top, then the systems and processes, the reporting lines, frequent communication around the issues, and periodic measurement and reporting in a transparent fashion. In India, the regulation will soon require the top 1,000 listed companies, for starters, to produce what are called the business responsibility and sustainability reports. So the minute a lot of this information starts becoming transparently provided to the market, you'll have many more players then scrutinizing, analyzing, naming and shaming, in the case of some investors, withdrawing the investments from companies they don't trust. And you'll have third-party validation of a lot of the data points companies put out. So I think that will then create a virtuous cycle where companies start understanding they need to do this better and better, tell a better story, which is more believable and authentic, and get third parties to validate that, credible third parties. But it'll all go back, as I said, starting with the board. The board has to be in the loop, aligned, understand this is important, and really set the tone at the top.
So this can be like a competitive advantage or a race to the top for organizations. And you've spoken about corporate India and sort of how prepared their skills to be able to respond to this scrutiny that is likely to happen sooner rather than later. Do we have the skills? I think people are still coasting along.
So the first point, is it a race to the top? I believe so. And I believe that there will be a shakeout that will take place in companies that don't move speedily to, you know, get their act together and do better will be found out and will then be dropped like hot potatoes from portfolios, initially of foreign investors. And then pretty soon, as Indian investors join the party, I think many of these companies will find that they're getting dumped because investors don't believe in the story. Likewise with retail investors, likewise with customers. As I mentioned, millennials are now much more sensitive. People are going to be looking at labels and products, for instance, very carefully scrutinizing what goes into those products, what the carbon footprint is. I think there's a reason why a company like Unilever announced last year that all 70,000 of its consumer products would carry labels showing their carbon footprint. I think they get it. They understand that this will be a competitive advantage. If you can engage with your stakeholders and especially your customers and demonstrate that you're working in the right direction, I think you have a much greater chance of getting them to buy your products and to align with your brand. So I think the best Indian companies get that. My concern, as I said earlier, is really the small and medium enterprises that for a variety of reasons, not that they don't necessarily want to do the right thing. Some of them are very high-minded about the values and the direction they want to take the business. But they may not have the access to, in some cases, capital, in some cases, technology. In many cases, just information and understanding of what's changing in their businesses. Take the whole auto industry, for instance. The auto component space is a massive supporter of the OEMs in India. And yet, when you think about the changes that are going to take place because of concerns around the climate issue, because of concerns around pollution, and the migration towards electric vehicles, many of these auto component producers who produce parts that go into, let's say, the internal combustion engine, are suddenly going to find that they don't have a significant market left anymore. Now, if they can't make the changes in terms of their own strategy, investing in new production lines with new technology that services electric vehicles rather than vehicles based on the IC engine, they're going to be in deep trouble. But do they really know which direction they need to move in? And do they have access to the technology? Have they been investing in R&D so that they can make this pivot fast enough? Those are all big, big challenges.
Absolutely. I just wanted to ask you, so can the bigger corporates, because, you know, these auto components manufacturers, they work with the big auto companies, can this be a part of their supplier diversity or preparing the suppliers for the future? Because I can't see how they're going to otherwise cross that bridge.
Correct. Now, this again goes back to corporate responsibility. How do the larger corporates see their responsibility to their supply chain partners? What kind of approach to partnership have they had over the years? In the book, we talk a lot about the focus in the long term. And I think companies that are more long-term oriented tend to value these partnerships more and would be perhaps willing to make the investments in their supply chain partners who come from the SME space to help them to, you know, navigate these uncertainties. But if you actually see what's been happening in the Indian auto industry, the fact of the matter is, in the last 20 years, I think pretty much every single big name OEM has really been investing in trying to streamline their vendor base and actually narrow the vendor base. So you're seeing concentration take place there as well. The whole idea of reducing your reliance on too many small participants and trying to consolidate a lot of the component activity in fewer, more manageable big players. So that's going to be one challenge that I see coming up, that actually this opens up an opportunity to even further reduce dependency on a very large number of players and try and sort of create a few bigger players who have the scale to then drive economies of scale in their own operation. So it's going to be a real challenge. That's why I said it's going to throw up all kinds of difficult problems. And I'm not sure how much people have thought through these. The other space where also, I mean, we're talking about an auto industry that perhaps will survive maybe in a slightly different avatar. But think about industries that are probably on their way out permanently. So with all the focus on, for instance, coal mining or focus on thermal power, many players are now saying that they're either going to shut down what they've done in the recent past, not stop doing it any further. Tata Power is a case in point. No new investments in thermal power going forward. A lot more focus on renewables. And similarly, you're seeing in the mining space, fewer and fewer claimants for new licenses. What happens to those industries when crunch time comes and you have to take a strong call on what you do with those assets? So you have stranded assets and you potentially have businesses that have no future. You know, one of the biggest companies in India, the public sector, is Coal India Limited. They employ a little under 300,000 people, and they have a few million pensioners. Now, if the government of India has to seriously live up to its ambitions at Glasgow, there will need to be some curbs on at least the coal-related activity of Coal India. They're also trying to now pivot towards some form of renewables and so on. But if that doesn't happen fast enough, and there are assets that have to be, for whatever reason, temporarily shut or permanently shut, what happens to all those workers? And that's where you have this concept of the just transition. Yeah. So I can see sort of major challenges coming up within this decade because of the urgency of the climate change issue, but so also many of the other social issues that we have, as we discussed earlier, the role of women in society, the role of scheduled castes and scheduled tribe community members in the power structure. So, you know, right now these seem to be small sort of points of concern, but I think they're all going to become very, very big issues before the next 2 or 3 years pass.
Absolutely. Agree on that. So corporate India is by and large very conservative when it comes to encouraging dissent or alternate points of view. And this, because you've worked in corporate India. In this age of employee activism, how can they prepare for not just external but internal disruptions? Because crushing it is not an option you want to consider. And I think corporate India has this habit of attributing any dissent to sort of outside influences or competitor action. But it could be just because, like you mentioned, millennials are more aware. Generally, by and large, people are more aware about their rights and what stand a company should be taking or how they should be behaving.
Absolutely. I think, again, the best companies tend to nurture a culture that is open and transparent. In India, too few of our companies necessarily encourage that kind of openness and transparency. And you can see it in the employee engagement numbers. So Gallup does these periodic studies. And I think in the book, I quote one of the more recent ones, which suggested employee engagement in India was around 13%. It's absurdly low. Now, the point to be noted is also that it's not much better in most other markets around the world.
Yeah.
And so clearly, employees in most markets tend to feel disengaged and really show up to work because, you know, they're getting a livelihood from that, but aren't necessarily very excited or passionate about what they do at the workplace. But if you could improve that, and there is data to show what happens when you do improve that, your performance can dramatically improve, your returns can improve, you start attracting better quality of investors. So I think there is a lot that companies need to do to address the kind of internal sentiment that employees have about who they're working for and why they're working. It goes back to your initial question about purpose. If you can persuade people that there is really a long-term purpose and they're part of a shared vision of the future, you've been very inclusive in dealing with them and taking their contribution, their participation, and drafting your strategy going forward, you know, magic can happen. And that is so important given the nature of the challenges that we face ahead of us. So you need your employees to feel committed, to feel participative, and that they're really wanted and they're included in the game plan going forward. I also believe that one of the reasons India does so poorly on R&D and innovation, you know, we have one of the lowest R&D spend as a percentage of GDP at 0.7%. It's around a third or less of what China spends, for instance, on a much higher revenue base. And it's, again, lower than what the Western economy spent. And part of the reason for that is I think we don't encourage enough dissent, enough challenge, enough risk-taking within our organizations. That goes back to the culture you talked about. Because dissent is crushed in many companies, you don't get the best ideas. You don't invest behind new efforts to grow and develop your business or to test new technologies or to explore new markets. And that can be sort of the undoing of many Indian corporations going forward.
Yeah, true. So essentially, when we talk about ESG, it is a way for investors to protect funds from systemic risks in the long term, right? At the end of the day, funds are driven by profits. Can we really put ESG in the driving seat to drive social impact and sustainability?
Absolutely, because I think those are integral to the way people now perceive risk. Again, in the book, I sort of give an instance of the World Economic Forum, the surveys of you know, some of the largest multinational enterprises around the world. And what do they see as a risk? And it's interesting, if you go back 15 years, you know, something like an epidemic or a healthcare crisis was seen as perhaps the only ESG-linked risk. And now there are a range of ESG-linked risks, the biggest obviously being climate change. Yeah. So I think businesses understand, investors understand that ESG issues embed both risk and opportunity. And if you can mitigate the risk and work on the opportunity, you know, there's upside potential. But if you've not fully understood what the risks are and you're not investing for the future and opportunities, you know, these companies are going to be left behind and no investor wants to have a part of those. So I think it will have its impact on not just the G, but certainly the E and the S of companies.
Yeah,
I think this is here to stay with us.
Good to hear that. That's very, very positive. And finally, any advice for Better.com CEO Vishal Garg? What was he thinking?
I don't know. The timing was terrible. The way it was done, I think, left so much to be desired. It didn't sort of come through as an effort that demonstrated empathy and understanding of the space in which employees are and such a large number of people to be treated in this fashion. So it goes back to the point that we were just talking about, right?
Yeah.
Do employees feel included? Do they feel they're part of the strategy? Do they understand where the organization is leading them? Or are they treated as sort of dispensable commodities to be exploited and then thrown away the minute their use has ended or the company finds itself in a difficult space? So it's probably about all the stuff that's wrong about the way we think about corporate responsibility. And let me sort of stop there. I think clearly he's got such a huge amount of flack.
Thank you so much, Mukund. And all the very best for your book.
Thank you so much, Sudha. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.